Well, hello, everyone. I'm James Dobson, and you're listening to Family Talk, a listener-supported ministry. In fact, thank you so much for being part of that support for James Dobson Family Institute.
Hello, friends, and welcome to Family Talk, the broadcast division of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute. I'm Roger Marsh, and I hope your week is going really smoothly. Perhaps you got a free coffee from a friend. That's always fun. Or maybe you were filled with the excitement of watching your child or grandchild accomplish something new for the very first time. Well, whether it was a little win or a huge victory, I know that we all have something to be grateful for today. And also, Valentine's Day is 1 week from today. Guys, hint, hint, maybe you and your significant other will celebrate this weekend or maybe on the day itself. Well, whichever you choose, this is your friendly reminder to plan something nice to honor that person and your love for each other. And perhaps think of doing a nice gesture for a friend or family member who might be feeling lonely this Valentine's Day. Maybe it's a parent who lost their spouse and this will be their first Valentine's Day alone. Or perhaps, if you're single, you might plan to get together with your other single friends and do something fun. Well, regardless of how you celebrate, make sure that you have gratitude in your heart this Valentine's Day. Now, today's broadcast is about a man you may have heard of. His name is Louis Zamperini. Some of you might know him from the movie Unbroken, which features his life story. Louis's life began with humble beginnings, and he was born to Italian immigrant parents. Louis had an older brother named Pete and two younger sisters named Virginia and Silva. When Louis was 2 years old, his family moved from New York State to Long Beach, California, and that's where he became a bit of a troublemaker, involved in smoking and drinking. He also struggled with bullies. During his high school years, he was encouraged to join the track team, and he became faster and faster. He eventually earned a scholarship to attend the University of Southern California, Dr. Dobson's alma mater. Now, before attending USC, Louis decided to try out for the Olympic team. At the age of 19, he was the youngest American to qualify for running the 5,000 meters. That's a distance of just over 3 miles. And you know what? He still holds that 5,000-meter record even today. This achievement led him to the 1936 Berlin Olympics. And then in 1940, Louis graduated from USC and was looking forward to competing in the Olympics that year as well. However, World War II kicked off, and the 1940 Summer Olympic Games that were set to take place in Tokyo were canceled. The following year, Louis enlisted in the United States Army Air Force. About 2 months later, the attack on Pearl Harbor occurred, and that drew the U.S. into World War II. Now Louis was serving as a bombardier on the consolidated B-24 Liberator aircraft. His job as a bombardier was to aim the bombs at their targets, making Louis a part of the war effort from the air. Things took a turn, one fateful flight mission that had a major mechanical failure, and his plane went down into the ocean. Of 11 men on the aircraft, only 3 survived the crash, and one of them was Louis Zamperini. Then began a 47-day struggle simply to stay alive, stranded in the ocean. They eventually washed ashore on a Pacific island and were taken as prisoners of war by Japanese forces. For over the next 2 years, Louis Zamperini would be starved, physically and psychologically tortured. And then he was eventually released upon the end of the war in 1945 and subsequently returned home. A year later, Louis met his wife, Cynthia. They instantly fell in love and were engaged after only 2 weeks of dating. Together, they had 2 children, Sissy and Luke. Early in their marriage, Louis suffered from PTSD from the war, and it had a drastic effect on their relationship. In 1949, he attended a crusade led by Billy Graham, and that set him on a path to healing. Louis Zamperini became a Christian evangelist, sharing a message of forgiveness. He even visited with the guards of the POW camps where he was held prisoner to let them know he had forgiven them. Louis and Cynthia Zamperini were married for 55 years before she went home to be with the Lord in 2001. Louis lived to be 97 years of age and experienced his homecoming in 2014. Well, joining Dr. James Dobson today on this classic edition of Family Talk, you'll hear our very own Dr. James Dobson having a conversation with Louis's son, Luke Zamperini, and his wife, Lisa. Luke will be sharing personal stories about his father. Luke is the president and CEO of the Louis Zamperini Foundation. Lisa is the executive director at the Louis Zamperini Foundation, and together they have one son, his name is Clay, who is also on the board serving alongside his parents. Clay even made an appearance in the movie Unbroken as the Olympic torchbearer, by the way. Well, now let's join Dr. James Dobson and his guests, Luke and Lisa Zamperini, right here on this special edition of Family Talk.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about. In fact, more than we're going to get done today, and maybe more than we can get done in about 3 weeks. So I hope you're not planning to go home. You and I have been talking about the stories that surround him and surround your family. And they're really just kind of breathtaking because of what he went through. I call him a national treasure or a hero. You agree with that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I have a senatorial bipartisan resolution and a congressional bipartisan resolution, both declaring Louis Zamperini to be a national hero.
You were very close to him, weren't you?
Yes, I was very close to my father. I loved being with him. I loved taking him places. I used to take him on his speaking engagements and listen to him tell his story over and over and over again, and I never got tired of hearing it.
Frequently, when you know the backstory of heroes, there's more to it than meets the eye. And if you knew all the facts, you might be a little disappointed. In his case, it's not a disappointment. The way he lived his life and his love for Jesus Christ in the latter years of his life, and many, as a matter of fact, even though he was not a Christian in his younger years, it is as impressive as we think it is, wasn't it?
Well, yes. And as a matter of fact, the less savory portions of his story are the things that built his experience to get him to the point where he did become a Christian.
Well, he was kind of a rascal when he was a little kid. The book Unbroken tells us more than the movie did. But he really was a handful, wasn't he?
Yes, he was a terror to his community of Torrance, California. So Louis began smoking when he was 5 years old. He was so quick on his feet that he used to steal alcohol from bootleggers in the area. And he was a very resourceful guy when it came to breaking the law. In those days in Torrance, there was no air conditioning. So on a hot summer day, they would, instead of closing the doors to a business, they would pull these iron gates shut in front of it and let the air through the iron gates. Well, on Sundays, when everybody was in church, Louis would go get his fishing rod and go down the main street in Torrance, and he'd fish through these iron gates and snag cigarettes and candies and whatever else that he could. And that way he was able to, you know, steal from these stores without actually going inside the store.
Why was he like that? Was that just his temperament? Did he have a tough home life? What made him like that?
Well, he was inherently a defiant person. You know, even when he was punished, he never cried. He had a loving family. His mother and father, being Italian immigrants, were good parents. He had a brother and two sisters. Yet Louis was just incorrigible. He was smart and could figure out ways to get what he wanted. I think it was the attention that he was getting from when he got caught. It was my Uncle Pete who finally figured out that if he could channel Louis's energies into sports, he might be able to keep him from going to jail. Mm-hmm. And so he got together with the chief of police in Torrance, California, and got the chief of police to convince the school principal to allow Louis to participate in sports, even though he didn't have the grades to do so, and even though he was constantly in trouble in school.
And he turned out to be a great athlete. He was a runner.
He did. He went into, the police chief said, well, since we've been chasing him all over town all these years, I suggest running would be a good sport for him. And so he went out for distance running at Torrance High School.
And was fast.
He was. His event was the mile. Even though he ran half miles and 2 miles in cross country, The mile is what he ran. And being a high school student at Torrance High, he set the national collegiate record for the mile at 4 minutes, 21 seconds and change. That was held for 19 years.
That may not sound fast now, but it was faster than anybody in the world at the time.
The world record still hadn't broken the 4 minute mile, and it was, I forget what the mile record was at the time, but when my dad finally got into college, he set the national collegiate record at 4 minutes, 8.3 seconds.
At USC.
University of Southern California. And that record held for 14 years. Mm.
He actually ran the 5,000-yard distance in the Olympics of 1936 when Jesse Owens was the sensation.
Yeah, that's right. The positions that were open for the mile run or the 1,500-meter run in the Olympic team was already taken up. And so my uncle enrolled my father for the 5,000-meter run, and he'd never run it before. The second time he ran the 5,000 meters, he actually tied the world record holder, Don Lash, and got himself onto the U.S. Olympic team in 1936.
Hmm. 1936 was the year that Adolf Hitler made a political thing out of the Olympics. And, of course, Jesse Owens was black, and Hitler hated any races other than the Aryan race, which he saw as representing Germany. We remember those Olympics because of the prelude to World War II. Shirley and I have been to Berlin, and we went to that stadium, and I've stood in the place where Adolf Hitler sat, and of course the press and all the other folderol that went along with that Olympics took place there in that year.
In 1936, you know, he made the team running the 5,000 meters. Interestingly enough, his roommate in the Olympic Village in Germany was Jesse Owens and Mack Robinson, the brother of Jackie Robinson. They were tasked at keeping the young Zamperini out of trouble, which they did to some extent. But after he ran his final heat of the 5,000 meters, a heat where he actually set a record for the very last lap in that 5,000 meters at 56 seconds. That was so fast that it drew the attention of Adolf Hitler, who then summoned him to the podium, which you were talking about, because he wanted to meet the boy with the fast finish. So they met. They shook hands briefly, and it was interesting because Hitler refused to shake Jesse Owens' hand, but he shook Jesse's roommate's hand instead.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no great honor in that.
No, none at all.
But your dad stole a flag, a swastika flag, with the black and red colors.
Yes, after his heat, he went and sampled some of the automats that they had in the Olympic Village. And you could put a couple of Pfennig in the machine, and out would come a liter of beer. So he had a couple of liters of beer and went wandering through the city, and he found himself in front of the Reich Chancellery building. And there were all these Nazi swastikas on flagpoles hanging off the front of the building. And he decided that he really wanted to have one of those as a souvenir. So there were guards walking to and fro in front of the building. And he figured his timing would be correct. Just as those guards passed each other, that he would take a dash for the building and get up the side of it and grab a flag and be gone before they knew what happened. Of course, he got up the side of the building and the flag was a little higher than he thought it would be. So it took him a little longer to get a hold of it. But when he did,
they took a shot at him.
Yeah, he dropped to the ground with his flag in his hands and started running. And the guards saw him and they were yelling, "Haltensee, Haltensee." And finally, he believed he heard the crack of a rifle, you know, the shot in the air to make him stop. And he stopped. They collared him and then they saw his American Olympic insignia on his uniform. And they started to question him as to why he had taken the flag. And he just charmed them and said it was because he wanted a souvenir of the wonderful time he had in this most beautiful of countries. And so they held him in place there for a while. They went back into the building and got permission to give him the flag. And he's we still have that flag. It's in the Zamperini Airfield in Torrance, California, on display with some of his other war memorabilia.
Now, the winds of war, World War II, were blowing at that time. And And we know now what occurred shortly after that. But your dad went into the there wasn't an Air Force, but the Army Air Force.
Yes, there was the Army Air Force that later became the Air Force. And my dad volunteered to go into the Army Air Force before Pearl Harbor. A lot of men were seeing the winds of war coming, and in support of their country, they started volunteering before there even was a draft. And so he went into the Army Air Force, and he washed out as a pilot, but he was very mechanically minded and did very well with the Norden bomb sight. So they turned him into a bombardier on a B-24 Liberator. And then he served in the Pacific Theater, being based on Oahu. He went on several bombing raids, one of which was Wake Island. Another one was the Nauru raid, which is, of course, dramatized at the beginning of the film Unbroken. And then it was a subsequent mission he went on that was actually a rescue mission looking for a downed B-25, you know, about 200 miles from Palmyra Island around the Central Pacific. It was a borrowed airplane.
The war with Japan was well underway.
Oh, well underway, yes.
And Pearl Harbor had occurred.
It had occurred, and this was Pearl Harbor happened December 7th, 1941, and this was May 1943 when he went on this reconnaissance mission. They were flying at just under 1,000 feet below the cloud cover, looking to see if they could find any wreckage or any survivors of this B-25 that had ditched there. When the airplane that they were using, this B-24, was a borrowed plane, and it had engine problems. You know, at under 1,000 feet, this plane just cartwheeled straight into the ocean, landing on its left side, and just blew to pieces. Now, my father, to brace for the crash, he got back by the waist gunner area, and he had a rubber life raft, you know, uninflated. He was holding it in his arms, and when the plane hit the water, it shoved him under the waist gunner machine gun tripod. And so he was stuck under this tripod with this raft in his stomach. And then the tail of the airplane sheared off, and all the cables that ran from the flight deck back to the rudder and the tail, they coiled around that tripod. Now he was entombed in this tripod with all these wires holding him in there, and he was unable to free himself. And the plane began to sink. And he was really good at holding his breath for a long time. He timed himself at being able to hold his breath underwater for 3 minutes and 45 seconds. And so he held his breath.
The great athlete was still in good shape.
Still in great shape. As a matter of fact, he ran a 4-minute, 12-second mile just the day before this plane crash. So now he's sinking, unable to free himself. And the last thing he remembers saying to himself was, "God help me." And then he blanked out. He said it felt like a sledgehammer had hit him in the head, and he was out cold. Then he comes to, and he thinks that this must be the afterlife. But he had a sensation of floating. He was completely freed from this entombment that he had and knew that he was floating upward in the aircraft, although it was so deep now that it was dark and he couldn't see. And what happened was his USC ring had caught on to the waist gunner window, and it caught on there, and there was so much force from the plane sinking and his own buoyancy trying to take him up that it cut through his skin all the way to the bone on his ring finger. So then he realized that he was in the waist gunner window, and he pulled himself out and then shot to the surface. And for the rest of his life, he could never figure out how he got freed in that aircraft. It had to have been a miracle. As a matter of fact, he was convinced that he had a guardian angel that had freed him from that. And whenever he would pray, he would put a good word in for that guardian angel, who he named Victor for victory.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my memory from reading that there were 11 of his airmen buddies that were killed in that crash. Is that right?
That's correct. There was 11 men on the crew. All died except for three: my dad, the pilot, Russell Phillips, and the tail gunner, Francis McNamara. They survived the crash. My dad got to the surface. The ocean was on fire. You know, he was throwing up all the water and blood and hydraulic fluid that he was inhaling as he was going up to the surface. He saw the two other survivors clinging to a piece of wreckage and blood just shooting out of the pilot's head. So he was able to catch another raft and pick up the other two survivors. And that began a 47-day odyssey in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
You said that without a lot of emphasis. 47 days on a raft with no – did they have no water? They had a little bit of food, didn't they?
They had what was on this raft. Now, first thing he did once he stopped the bleeding on the pilot's head was he took inventory of what was in these two rafts. And he used to joke to me that he was certain that those rafts had to have been provisioned by the Japanese Navy because there was nothing in there for these Americans to survive on. There were six chocolate bars and three tins of water, and each tin was about 12 ounces. So there really wasn't much there, but it was enough for three men to survive on for a week. The very first night, the tail gunner panicked and ate all the provisions. He ate all those chocolate bars. And so there was nothing for my father and the pilot, Russell Phillips. They thought that they would be rescued pretty soon, but it just didn't happen. So day after day after day, they finally figured out that they were drifting westward. When they finally saw an airplane that was far to the east of them, and that was in the flight lanes between Hawaii and Palmyra Island. So they realized they had drifted west, and they were continuing to drift west, and they figured that eventually they would drift into probably the Gilbert or Marshall Islands in the Western Pacific. Of course, the problem was those islands were under the control of the Japanese Navy at that time.
Mm-hmm. So they were not making any progress in finding land where they could have survived. Now they're into the second week, the third week, and fourth. And what happened to the three men?
Well, they had no more food to eat. So fortunately, one day, an albatross landed on the raft.
And it's a bird.
It's a bird. It's a pretty big bird. And so my dad grabbed it by its feet, and they broke its neck. And they cut it open to eat it. And, of course, this was the first of three albatrosses that they had caught over their 7-week journey. And they tried to eat this one. They just couldn't do it. It was raw bird meat. It was just, terrible. The second one that they caught several weeks later, they were able to choke it down. The third one that they caught, he told me it tasted like a hot fudge sundae to him. They were so hungry at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So they had three birds, half a dozen small fish, and they'd also caught two sharks and ate what they could of those during their journey.
We're going to have to pick up this story next time.
Okay.
And we've been talking to Luke Zamperini, and his wife Lisa is sitting here. This is just the beginning. Well, what happened from then to the end of the war is the main aspect of this story that is told in the movie, and it will get your attention, I tell you. It'll move you. Thank you for being with us today, Lisa. Thank you, and your silence for being with us. And we will talk to you both next time. Thanks for being here.
Okay. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And there is so much more to hear from Luke and Lisa Zamperini as they share stories about Luke's dad, the iconic war hero, Louis Zamperini. Be sure to join us again on Thursday and then again on Friday here on Family Talk for the remainder of this inspiring conversation. And remember, if you missed any part of today's program, you can listen to it again at drjamesdobson.org/Family Talk. You know, in marriage, it's important not to take each other for granted, especially when it comes to the little things, like taking out the trash or picking up some milk on the way home. In Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verses 9 and 10, we read, "Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If either of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up." If you're married, perhaps it's time to take a moment to think about those little things that your spouse does for you and let them know how grateful you are for all those little things that they do. By the way, if you and your spouse would like to grow a little closer in your relationship with the Lord and each other, try our special 10-day marriage series from the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute. Prayer is very powerful, and it really can change all kinds of situations, especially your marriage. To take the marriage challenge, all you have to do is visit drjamesdobson.org/10-day marriage series. Then simply input your email address and click on the sign up button. From the day you sign up and then for the next 10 consecutive days, you'll receive an encouraging email from Dr. James Dobson about how to strengthen your marriage. The email will also include some words of wisdom from Dr. Dobson and some questions for you and your spouse to answer, as well as a prayer that you can say together in concluding that day's devotional. Now, every marriage requires attention, dedication, and hard work to realize the gifts that God intended for marriage. So when you sprinkle in some love, trust, and grace, you have a pretty nice recipe. To learn more about how to strengthen your marriage with our 10-day marriage series from the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute, go to drjamesdobson.org/10-day marriage series. Well, I'm Roger Marsh, and you've been listening to Family Talk, the voice you trust for the family you love. We'll see you again next time.
This has been a presentation of the Dr. James Dobson Family Institute.